here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
Today is Friday, March 2nd. I'm Chirag Mahajan. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia, to the UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca. Good evening. It is 5:02 and time for another full hour of independent news. Our headlines will cover news from the UBC campus, local news from Metro Vancouver, provincial news from across BC, as well as news from around the world. Also today, in our studio, News 101 will be talking to Amna Chaudhry, a sister social and education coordinator from the Muslim Students Association here at UBC. And we'll ask her about how their association has been promoting Muslim culture among people of all religions throughout their recent week-long event called Islam Awareness Week. Later in the show, we'll also air two interviews by Amy Goodman from Democracy Now! With Salil Shetty, the Secretary General of Amnesty International, discussing the humanitarian situation in Syria. And another interview with Kristen Hranson, a WikiLeaks spokesperson. All this plus your weekend weather forecast right here on News 101, your source for independent news. And now for your UBC campus headlines. After 5 years of negotiations, consultations and planning, UBC finally broke ground for the new sub. The groundbreaking ceremony on Wednesday featured an open house with posters showing the history of the UBC's subs and artist renditions of the new sub. Currently, the construction of the 250,000 square foot new sub is on schedule for completion in 2014 and is also on budget. The new sub will feature a brewery, a garden, rooftop childcare center, as well as numerous new restaurants and club spaces. News 101 reporter Nina Carigia was at the open house and shares with us her recordings of the speeches by UBC President Stephen Toop and outgoing AMS VP Administration Mike Soulet, both of whom praised everyone, especially our student leaders, who've been working on the project since 2007. First, we have Mike Soulet giving us some historical perspective of UBC's several student union buildings.
Years ago, moving into the new sub meant moving into the building we're in today. This was because Brock Hall was the first student union building. It's true that the AMS has had a very rich history in partnering with the university to build buildings on campus. I'll list a few. The first stadium at UBC, which was where the current sub stands today, the 1960 Thunderbird Winter Sports Center, Brock Hall, the Aquatic Center, the Student Union Building, and now the new Student Union Building. These are all projects that students have led the way in for the betterment of the university as a whole. However, such incredible projects don't happen without incredible leadership. All of these past leaders and leaders of today have been acting around one goal, to involve as many students as possible. It started with day-long workshops, information sessions, voting on which architect we wanted, and then when we started designing the building, we erected the design cube, where any student can walk in, see the plans, and give their opinion. This is truly why the new Student Union building is unique and will be treasured by students for generations to come. Today we're celebrating the achievement of not just these remarkable leaders, but also of many other student leaders, alumni, staff, who have made the sub a reality.
And slight technical difficulty there. The volume's quite low, but if you turn up your radio, it might be all good. And now, UBC President Stephen Toop expresses his gratitude towards the generations of hardworking AMS student leaders who've been working for future generations of UBC students.
Well, I'm sure there are some amongst you who are perhaps surprised that we've actually reached this day. I want to say that I'm not surprised because, as Mike has so eloquently indicated, we have been blessed with now generations of student leaders for whom the sub has been a top priority. And they have envisioned it, and they have made it happen, working in very close collaboration with some of my favorite colleagues from UBC, UBC Properties Trust, people who have themselves dedicated hundreds of hours of very hard work to negotiating how this relationship would work going forward, to negotiating what the building would look like in collaboration with thousands of students who have had the opportunity through the Design Cube and other fora to contribute their perspective and their ideas. I want to highlight one thing, though, that perhaps hasn't yet come out in the wonderful remarks from Mike. And it's something that I think we should all be really proud about, and students in particular. Yes, there have been generations of students who've worked hard on this project. But more than that, it's generations of students working for future generations of students. This was not in any way about the student leaders who are currently here or were here in the last few years. This building is, as you said, for generations of students to come. That takes courage, it takes foresight, and it takes remarkable political acumen to get a generation of students here and now to commit to support through their own money and their passion and hard work a building that's going to serve students only in the future. I think that says something about UBC students, and I want to highlight it. I think it says that our students do have the capacity to think big. They have the capacity to be global citizens, not concerned only about their own personal interests. They have the capacity to think about the future, and indeed, and even more excitingly, to shape the future. I can't tell you how proud that makes me feel as president. So my main word today is simply a word of thanks. Thank you to generations of student leaders who've made this happen. Thank you to staff at UBC who've worked so hard in collaboration with those student leaders, to UBC Properties Trust that's given such helpful advice in the whole process. Thank you to the wonderful team of architects who've given a lively vitality to that original vision. Thank you to all of you for supporting this project. I cannot wait to be at the opening ceremony. Thank you very much.
That was UBC President Stephen Toop speaking at the open house for the new Student Union Building's groundbreaking ceremony on Wednesday. In more campus news, the recent euthanizing of four macaque monkeys after being used in Parkinson's disease research here at UBC has sparked outrage amongst local anti-vivisectionists. Anne Berthistle, a volunteer with the animal rights group Stop UBC Animal Research, and co-director of the Animal Defense and Anti-Vivisection Society of BC, said in an interview with the Georgia Strait, quote, "We're calling for an end to animal research at the University of British Columbia and at all publicly funded institutions and private institutions. We believe in the scientific data that shows animal research is hazardous to human health, and there are far better human-based, progressive approaches that we should be using," end quote. Brian Vincent, director of Stop UBC Animal Research, said UBC must be held accountable for the deaths. Quote, "First of all, if they had abided by their protocols, which were approved for their animal care committee, it's highly unlikely all four would have died. Maybe one because of a mistake, but all four? Something went wrong." End quote. The monkeys had to be euthanized after suffering from an apparent extreme allergic reaction to the drug, which was supposed to be incrementally induce, which is supposed to incrementally induce the symptoms of Parkinson's disease. Helen Burt, Associate Vice President of Research at UBC, said of the reaction, quote, "The individual doesn't know that they're allergic to the antibiotic. Then they have an unanticipated reaction to that drug, and this is what happened in this case. So we clearly take all kinds of heroic measures with the animals, but in this case, although there was a complete team available whenever these drugs are given to these animals, it was felt that we had to use humane anesthesia to end the suffering of the animals," end quote. Helen Burt also added that it is unlikely that this incident will draw animal resting at UBC to a close. Sorry, animal testing at UBC to a close. Despite that, the University of Toronto recently ended their program. Quote, "The whole point of this research is to have a robust animal model of human disease so that we can explore new treatments. This is a devastating disease with no cure. Millions of people worldwide are affected by Parkinson's disease. And without this kind of research, we would simply not understand, number one, the disease, and number two, we would have no new treatments. So research using these models provides essential insight into the disease and brings us closer to the effective treatments." That was Helen Burt. And now for our interview with Amna Chaudhry, a sister social and education coordinator from the Muslim Student Association here at UBC. And we'll be talking to her about how their association has been promoting Muslim culture among people of all religions throughout their recent week-long event called Islam Awareness Week that took place from February 13th to the 17th. And we recently, here at News 101, took the opportunity to invite the association to our studio. So, Amna, welcome to News 101.
Thank you.
So, could you talk to us about what you feel the significance of the week is?
Okay, so basically, Islam Awareness Week at UBC aims to do two things. Primarily, we aim to get rid of any misconceptions that people may have. Then there's so many due to like different things that they hear in the media or watch on the news even. So that, and also just to spread the message of Islam, because a lot of people don't actually know what Islam is all about. Like, they have no idea, no inkling. Like, some don't even know what it is, like the fact that it's even a religion. So pretty much that's our aim.
And do you of course you've talked to students throughout the week, and given the large number of students that walk through our student union building throughout the week, your volunteers must have like hopefully talked to them and had several long conversations in some cases, right? What do you think has been the response from these students?
Yeah, definitely. Actually, okay, well, in the student union building this year, what we did was we decided to switch it up a little. So usually, like, you know, there's a group of volunteers. Anyone can go ask questions if they want, but it's generally very passive. Like, you hand out a pamphlet, maybe people will read it, maybe they won't. This year, though, we switched it up, and we had like a museum style exhibit, and there were different stations, four different stations in particular. So people had to fill out a questionnaire and answer a question at each station, and in that way, like, they actually engaged in so much more dialogue, so many more questions were asked and answered, and yeah,
great.
People learned a lot.
Could you give us an example of what some people asked, if you might know?
Yeah, definitely. Okay, so
because there certainly are several misconceptions. I mean,
yeah, definitely. A lot of people had a lot of questions about Muslim women. So pretty much there's a whole big issue about the niqab in the media recently. So people were asking why Muslim women wear that, why Muslim women wear the hijab, the headscarf, other questions about women's rights in particular. So we invited them all to one of the events that happened during Islam Awareness Week, which was actually a discussion panel on women. And quite a few people came out, surprisingly.
Yeah.
To that, we had around 70 people turn out, and during that event, we answered a lot of those questions and more, told people on campus what the hijab was, what the niqab was, cleared a lot of misconceptions people had about women's rights in Islam, mm-hmm. And yeah, so it was really successful.
Could you tell us who was on that panel?
Yeah, definitely. There were two speakers, local speakers actually, one by the name of Mufti Asim Rashid. He's very involved in interfaith in the Vancouver community. And the other one was Sheikh Abdul Rahman Murad. And he is a religious leader in Vancouver as well.
Great. So you definitely had quite a local presence. I mean, people from Vancouver coming in. Yeah.
And we also had a woman speaker, actually.
That's great, yeah.
She's a UBC student, actually, I believe doing her graduate degree. And she spoke, she was actually one of the first speakers, and she spoke from a woman's perspective. So it was really cool to hear that as well.
Absolutely. It's very important to have that on a panel, talking about women's perspectives. Could you tell us... I remember reading up, I was doing some research on this, and last year the same Islam Awareness Week had a mosque set up in the Student Union building. Could you tell us what people's response was that last year? You were there last year, weren't you?
Yeah, I was actually, and it was a really neat idea because literally five times a day we as Muslims pray, and having that in the sub in front of everyone and stuff was really eye-opening for some people. It gave them a chance to observe how Muslims pray, first of all, the fact that they do pray, and making it so public was kind of more like inviting people to actually like come, ask questions, kind of intrigue them as well. This year we actually didn't have that because a lot of the times we found that people were looking and they were observing, but they weren't necessarily taking the step to come and ask about it. So by doing our questionnaire, we kind of had like kind of made them come ask about it.
Yeah.
And with the questionnaire thing, we also had a chance to win a free iPad too. So that definitely drew a lot of people.
That's great. Could you tell us, moving on from the week, could you tell us, going on to like common misconceptions or like understandings of Muslim culture in the media, for example, could you tell us how people are expected to change their conceptions of Muslim culture apart from like attending campus events, you know, which is very good on campus. It's amazing because you have students interacting with other students. But out there in like in Vancouver, in Canada, you know, how do people interact with such events and, you know, change their conceptions about Muslims in society?
Okay, well, I think the first thing that one must do is to inform themselves, because there is, you're not going to get rid of any misconceptions if you don't actively go out and seek the knowledge. So by informing yourself, I mean like checking out different sources. The internet can be one, but keep in mind that what you see on the internet is not always true.
Yes.
Right?
So you can't just type Muslim in Google and expect to get answers, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Well, you can get answers, but maybe not accurate ones.
Yeah.
So there's that as a resource, though. There is a lot of good stuff out there, just knowing where to look. Talking to Muslims themselves, actually, going to the primary source, right? Like, if Muslims believe in something, they probably know it best. Like, hopefully they know it best, right? So actually going out and seeking information from them. Also, there's, like, several local mosques in the area that they can visit, Islamic centers as well in Vancouver, and they're totally open. Like, their doors are always open to, like, give any kind of information, books even, pamphlets, you name it.
Great. Could you give us a little sneak peek on possible future events for the Muslim Students Association?
Definitely. Okay, well, we have the weekly recurring events. So there's the Brothers and Sisters Education Circles. We have Friday prayers as well. In addition to that, we have a lot of different events, such as like more academic events, lectures, seminars. We have another like social aspect to it. So we have different socials. We have sports. The MSA sisters are doing yoga, so check out their yoga classes. There's a whole bunch going on. You can check it all out at the website, so that's www.msaubc.org, and all the information is totally up there.
That's great. Well, thank you to Amna Chaudhry for giving us a brief insight into the Islam Awareness Week, of course, and about Muslim culture itself. Thank you for being on News 101.
You're welcome. Thank you for your time.
Great. Well, we're going to take a quick break, play a couple of PSAs. Stay tuned for your local and provincial news. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia.
Bond. James Bond.
You have to ask yourself one question. Do I feel lucky? Well, do you, punk?
You talking to me?
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, I am.
Plastics.
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Just a sweet transvestite. From transsexual Transylvania.
Where else can you see Hollywood blockbusters, midnight cult classics, indie films, live music, burlesque, stand-up comedy, poetry slams, and live sporting events all at your local theater? The Rio Theater, voted number one in East Vancouver, your neighborhood indie theater that promotes all things cool.
Now playing The Social Network at the Rio Theater, 1160 East Broadway at Commercial. Free parking plus save $2 on Cheap Date Tuesdays. For more information, go to riotheater.ca.
On Friday, March 2nd, UBC will be hosting its first ever Relay for Life. The Canadian Cancer Society's Relay for Life is a 12-hour overnight walk, giving communities the opportunity to celebrate cancer survivors, remember and honor loved ones lost, and fight for a future without cancer. You can expect games, yoga, food, and live entertainment to last the whole night. To learn more about the Relay, or for more information, please visit facebook.com/UBCRelay or the blog at ubcrelay.tumblr.com. That's the Canadian Cancer Society's Relay for Life, Friday, March 2nd at UBC.
Welcome back to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia. You could be listening to us online as well on CITR.ca, and don't forget to listen to past interviews in our podcasts at CITR.ca or on our Mixcloud.com page. And now for your local and provincial headlines. As teachers prepare to go on strike early next week, a recent poll suggests few British Columbians support a full-scale strike. An Ipsos Reid opinion poll of 1,030 adult BC residents found that when asked if they would support, quote, teachers taking a full-scale strike action, such as withdrawing classroom instruction for 4 days a week for 2 weeks, end quote, only 32% of respondents said they would support this move, while 62% said they would oppose it. However, more respondents opposed the government legislating an end to the dispute, with 43% supporting the idea, but 52% opposing it. As well, in response to the question, quote, which side do you think has been more fair and reasonable in these contract negotiations, end quote, teachers were supported by 31% of respondents, while the government received 29%. 23% neither side was being fair and reasonable. The BC Teachers Federation plans to continue the three-day walkout, commencing Monday. Students across BC staged a walkout today at 3 p.m. in support and response to the teachers' strike planned for next week. Hundreds of students in Vancouver met in the pouring rain at Vancouver Art Gallery to voice their opinions about the strike, as well as voice their own demands for increased funding for programs such as special help and after-school programs. Other similar displays occurred outside of high schools across the province, and more than 17,000 students signed up to the student walkout Facebook event. Obviously, the Facebook event is a strong indication of the student interest in this issue. However, Education Minister George Abbott says the rhetoric has gone too far, citing an incident in which he received a package of letters from grade 1 students in Victoria demanding he stop bullying teachers. Abbott said, quote, I'm sure all teachers, as well as all parents, share the view that this is appalling politicization of children, not only in the classroom, but in one of the earliest years of their lives in the classroom. End quote. That was George Abbott, Education Minister. The Greater Victoria District has launched an investigation into the incident, but already stated the teacher involved acknowledged a lack of judgment. Coquitlam RCMP are seeking the public's help in an investigation into three men who are allegedly involved in a mail fraud ring. Post-mail, that is. According to the police, these men cashed checks stolen from mail all over the Lower Mainland. Of the men, Corporal Jamie Chung said, quote, "They are relatives. They allegedly committed mail fraud in the Tri-City area mostly. Then they were cashing checks all over the place. I believe at one point they were living in the Tri-City area with a Tri-City address, and they were going from there." End quote. That was Corporal Jamie Chung. The men, Attila, age 48, Gula, age 47, and Gula, known as Johnny Orr Jr., age 23, strange name, I guess, Kuala Lumpur, are wanted on charges of mail fraud over $5,000. Full descriptions and pictures are available online at the Vancouver Sun's website, www.vancouversun.com. If anyone sees these men, they are advised not to approach them, but to contact the police immediately. A pair of skiers were found unharmed on Wednesday night after being trapped in a gully on North Vancouver's Grouse Mountain for several hours. The two men, both in their 20s, had skied down to the bottom of the cut mid-afternoon, then on foot took a trail to Skyline Drive in order to take the bus home. However, they got disoriented and consequently lost. They found themselves in the Mosquito Creek drainage, a notoriously steep area. They were forced in and out of the water at several points, and when they realized the terrain was too dangerous to continue, they called Grouse Mountain Resorts for assistance. Rescuers searched the ravine on foot, while an RCMP helicopter equipped with night vision searched from the sky. Rescuers reached them around 6:30 p.m., just as they were beginning to dig out a snow cave. Both men were uninjured. Tim Jones, NSR team leader, cautions, quote, "People should understand, you probably should not be trying to descend any trail on Grouse unless you're very familiar with it." The Abbotsford School District announced earlier this week that it has set up a task force to look into recent ecstasy-related deaths. There have been two recent deaths of young people, one student and the other a former student, and the district's Dave Stevens said, quote, "The deaths needed to have a more proactive response. We were having a drug discussion in schools anyways on an ad hoc basis, as we have over the years, but this situation demanded a more direct response." The task force will be made up of teachers, students, parents, and police, and will look at whether or not the district's drug prevention programs are effective, and if not, how they can be changed to better meet the needs of the community. The announcement of the formation of the task force comes on the tail of a recent ecstasy lab bust in Burnaby. It is still unclear as to whether or not this lab is related to the recent deaths. The recommendations of the force are expected by June 15th. And those are your local and provincial headlines on News 101. And now we have your local weather forecast for the weekend, brought to you by Phil from the UBC Storm Club. Phil is on the phone and he'll be joining us.
Hey, thanks, CJ.
Wait, hold on.
And good evening, listeners. A pretty well-developed warm front hugs the North American coastline this weekend, stretching all the way from Alaska to Washington. As it slowly travels eastward towards us, our cloud ceiling height will continue to drop, and light rain transitioning into scattered showers is expected. Winds will start to pick up a bit, but temperatures should remain relatively mild, mildly warm, that is. Looking more in the long term, we see a cold front behind the warm one, which we just discussed, probably due to arrive around midnight Sunday, possibly bringing to the mountain regions and another injection of precipitation to the metro area. Now, Here's your 3-day weekend weather forecast for UBC. Tonight, rain, low of 5. Saturday, rain, high of 7, low of 6. Sunday, rain, high of 7, low of 4. So that's your weekend weather forecast for UBC, brought to you by the UBC Storm Club. Currently, it is around 4 degrees on UBC campus. From home, reporting for News 101, I'm Phil Chang.
Thank you, Phil, for that local forecast from your home.
Thanks, Phil.
We're going to take a quick break, but stay with us for your international news, especially interviews by Amy Goodman from Democracy Now! You're listening to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver.
UBC Bookstore is having a student appreciation sale March 14th. Their way of saying thanks for all your support this past academic year. There will be snacks, DJs, and karaoke. Oh yeah, and discounts too. 25% off giftware, clothing, and stationery, 10% off computer accessories, and 20% off all general books. Visit the main store from 9:30 a.m. to 6 p.m. or the solder store from 10 to 5. UBC Bookstore, where your purchases support your UBC campus. CITR is proud to present Cab Calloway, Ray Charles, Aretha Franklin, and guests live at the Norm Theater. Okay, maybe not live, but nonetheless, it's a Blues Brothers beer garden, and it's going down March 16th in the Norm Theater in the Sub. Join Jake and Elwood Blues on their mission from God March 16th with CITR DJ spinning and cheap beer flowing.
It's 106 miles to Chicago. We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes. It's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses. Hit it.
Welcome back to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca. I'm Chirag Mahajan, and it's now time for your international news. Now we go to an interview conducted by Amy Goodman from Democracy Now!, who interviewed Kristen Hranson, a WikiLeaks spokesperson, who is involved in the group's recent project to release more than 5 million emails by U.S.-based intelligence gathering firm named Stratfor.
Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The whistleblowing website WikiLeaks has begun publishing what it says are 5.5 million emails obtained from the servers of Stratfor, a private U.S.-based intelligence gathering firm known to some as a shadow CIA. The emails for corporations and government agencies. The emails were reportedly obtained by the hackers group Anonymous. At a news conference in London Monday, WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange said the files implicate some of the world's largest firms and corporate espionage.
Today, WikiLeaks begins its release of 5,000 emails documenting the private lives and private lies of private spies. This is an organization that does not just collect information, collecting information through bribes, through insiders. It is also an organization that acts on that information to subvert particular groups, including WikiLeaks.
The companies in business with Stratfor are shown to have a keen interest in monitoring critics and activists. The firms include the soft drink giant Coca-Cola, which asked Stratfor to keep tabs on the protest plans of the group People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, or PETA, ahead of the 2010 Winter Olympics in Vancouver, Canada. The chemical industrial giant Dow Chemical is shown to have a major interest in activism around the 25th anniversary of the Bhopal chemical disaster, the 1984 gas leak that killed anywhere between 3,500 and 25,000 people. Of particular interest to Dow is the group the Yes Men, the anti-corporate pranksters who pulled off a famous 2004 hoax that led to the world to believe Dow had finally taken responsibility for the Bhopal tragedy. The emails also raise questions around potential ties between Stratfor and the investment giant Goldman Sachs. A former Goldman Sachs regional director, Shay Morenz, plays a major role in Stratfor and a new subsidiary, StratCap. The emails suggest Goldman may have also been a Stratfor client. Others that have dealings with Stratfor include Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, Raytheon, and U.S. government agencies, including the Department of Homeland Security, the Marines, and the Defense Intelligence Agency. For more on the Stratfor emails, we're joined by two guests. In London, Christian Hrantzen is with us, a spokesperson for WikiLeaks, who's been a key member of the project to release the Stratfor email. And here in New York, we're joined by Andy Bickelbaum, member of the Yes Men, a group that the emails show was monitored by Stratfor for the chemical giant Dow Chemical. The Yes Men's latest film is called The Yes Men Fix the World. I wanted to go first to London to ask you just about the release of these documents.
Well, Amy, I mean, we are working with 25 media organizations in who are pouring over the material and analyzing it, and we've only seen the tip of the iceberg when it comes to the stories based on the material. They will come out in the next coming days and weeks. What we were doing yesterday was introducing the project, the nature of Stratfor and how they operate and their ties. So, I mean, the most important stories I would suggest would come from our media partners in the next coming days. It will take, of course, time. They have access to a database which we have created with these 5 million emails, and we'll be searching for stories on the basis of that data.
Talk about some of the leaks that are coming out now. I mean, you're talking about 5.5 million email?
5 million, yes. As I said, it's a bit difficult for me to go into details concerning stories, although I know some of the stories, because we want our partners to publish those stories first. They will be coming out in the coming days. We have, of course, mentioned the connection that Stratfor has to some of the big corporations, working for Coca-Cola, for example, in Canada, as you mentioned, and monitoring PETA. We mentioned that to show the access that Stratfor had to government information, because it comes out in one of the emails that the Stratfor director is offering access to a secret FBI investigation into PETA. Then, of course, you have the information on how Dow Chemical did hire Stratfor to monitor the Yes Men and the Bhopal activists. There are other stories that have come out. For example, one that mentions the source of Stratfor in Israel. Claims that the Israelis had already taken action against Iran last year, the nuclear facilities. But in that instance, it was to point out that according to our journalists who are covering us in the Middle East, it's a very low-grade information that they are gathering in that region. And so it is difficult to say whether this is actually information of any quality. But on the other hand, this is information that is now being sold by Stratfor, even to U.S. government agencies.
The issue of Israel and Iran. The Israeli newspaper Haaretz reports some of the leaked emails suggest Israel may have sent commandos into Iran, perhaps with the assistance of Kurdish fighters or Iranian Jews, to carry out operations to destroy Iranian nuclear installations.
Yes, I can't really go into details on that story. It will come out in a day or two from one of our media partners, but we pointed out this email in the discussion about the nature of the material that Stratfor is gathering, and actually how they are operating in relation to their informants. For example, the CEO of Stratfor is urging his agent to use financial, sexual, and psychological control over the his informant in Israel to get information, more information from.
The issue of Pakistan government knowledge of the whereabouts of Osama bin Laden before his assassination, what has come out in the Stratfor email, Kristen?
It is a claim by Fred Burton, the vice president of Stratfor, that he has information that he had seen actually material that was obtained in Osama bin Laden's house after and gathered after he was assassinated, showing that top officials in the Pakistani secret services knew about the whereabouts of Osama bin Laden and actually were in frequent contact with him. This is to show that the vice president of Stratfor seems to have had pretty good access to information in the secret services in the U.S. And he was actually an agent at the State Department's secret services prior to joining Stratfor.
I wanted to go to the issue of Dow Corporation and the Yes Men. We're joined by Andy Bickelbaum. His real name is Jacques Servan. It's
thank you to Democracy Now! For that interview with Kristen Hranson, a WikiLeaks spokesperson. And now we go to Free Speech Radio for an update on the extreme violence in Syria, where a convoy of food and medical supplies being carried by the International Red Cross was blocked by the Syrian government.
International Red Cross has said a convoy carrying vital supplies and medical personnel has been blocked by government forces from entering the Baba Amr neighborhood of Homs. Eyewitnesses describe a city devastated by 4 weeks of bombing, and activists are warning of further arrests and attacks by security forces. Rebels from the Free Syrian Army, who pulled back from the area yesterday, described continued killings and torture of retreating forces, according to Reuters. In other parts of the country, protesters filled streets in Hama, Dara, Deir al-Zor, and districts in Damascus. Some video posted by activists appeared to show security forces firing on protesters. In the northern city of Idlib, crowds gathered to call for an end to the violence. For the latest, we go to Wissam Tarif, the Arab campaigner with Avaz. Activists from the organization were part of the rescue operation of Western journalists from Homs, in which at least 13 Syrian activists were killed. Tarif joins us from Beirut, Lebanon, where he's been monitoring the day's events. Welcome to FSRN.
Thank you.
What is the latest you have heard coming from Homs, and especially Baba Amr?
We managed to talk with an activist in Baba Amr in the last 14 hours ago, and he described a scene of massacre taking place, bodies everywhere, women, children, and men who were trying to flee to Al-Sultaniyah neighborhood, which is just next to Baba Amr, were trapped under shelling, and lots of bodies are in the streets. He talked about hundreds of dead and injured people.
And last you spoke with an activist in Homs. He did report that people were still actively fleeing, trying to get out of the area.
We don't know how many people managed to flee Baba Amr. There was a way in which people were getting out and in. That's how the journalists got out, the amazing network of brave activists who have been evacuating the injured. From inside Baba Amr. Nevertheless, that road has been exposed and it was shelled repeatedly. So, unfortunately, we suspect that very, very few people were able to flee the area.
The Syrian Red Crescent has said that the convoy is carrying food, medicines, blankets, milk for babies, and other equipment. What are the most pressing needs for the people there who have been cut off now for 4 weeks?
The infrastructure in the neighborhood has been totally destroyed. We're talking about a neighborhood without electricity, potable water, food, bread, baby formulas, medications, medical supplies. They're in need of everything. They have nothing. One of the journalists who was inside, and I met him the moment he crossed to safety to Lebanon, he made it very clear. There is no bread. There was no water for drink on the last day, even water for drinking. So people there need everything. They need to get into Bab al-Amr. That is the biggest crisis.
Wissam Tarif is the Arab campaigner with Avaaz. He joined us from Lebanon, where he's been monitoring events taking place in Syria. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Bye-bye.
Thank you to FSRN for that report. To follow up on their report, we now go to Amy Goodman on Democracy Now, who interviewed Salil Shetty, the Secretary General of Amnesty International, who was in New York recently to meet with the Secretary General of the United Nations, Ban Ki-moon. Salil spoke to Amy Goodman about the importance of having independent human rights monitors on the ground in Syria, especially after the apparent failure of the Arab League observers.
Well, the United Nations now says the death toll in the 11-month uprising in Syria has topped 7,500 as the Syrian government's crackdown continues on anti-government protesters and armed rebels. Activists say more than 250 people have died in the past 2 days alone, mostly from government shelling in Homs and Hama province. There are reports Syrian troops have begun a ground offensive on the opposition stronghold Homs, especially in the Bab al-Amr area. A Syrian official who spoke with the Associated Press vowed Bab al-Amr would be, quote, cleaned within hours. We're joined now by the Secretary General of Amnesty International, Salil Shetty, who is here in New York to meet with UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. Amnesty has been calling for Syria to give humanitarian aid agencies immediate and unhindered access to Homs and other affected areas. Amnesty is also closely monitoring events in Iran and Afghanistan. In Iran, Amnesty has exposed a crackdown on freedom of expression in the run-up to this week's parliamentary elections. Meanwhile, in Afghanistan, Amnesty reports 500,000 Afghans displaced by fighting are struggling to survive in makeshift shelters in the harshest winter the country's seen in years. Salil Shetty, Secretary General of Amnesty International, welcome to Democracy Now! First, talk about what you have found and are calling for in Syria.
I think the media reports are giving you the picture already, but our staff on the ground, Amnesty International is not allowed access into Syria, as you can imagine. In fact, that's one of our calls, that independent human rights monitors, including the UN body, should be allowed access. I don't think we can describe it in any more gory detail. It's unbelievable. It's outrageous. You know, crimes against humanity, the numbers spiraling every day. I think thousands of people have lost their life, and tens of thousands have been injured and affected, including children.
And so what do you think, what are you going to be telling Ban Ki-moon?
Well, the concern we have is that the international community, and particularly the Security Council, has got paralyzed in this regard. I mean, of course, the Syrians themselves are fighting a brave fight. Initially, it started completely as peaceful protests, and now it's ended up having to go beyond that. But there's a limit to what they can do from inside. So the international community has to rise up. And here, as you know, Russia and China are blocking any movement in the Security Council. And as far as the Russians are concerned, of course, they have some short-term business interests, because almost 10% of their arms sales go to Syria. But our view is that it cannot even be in the interest of Russia's own commercial interest, to alienate the entire Arab League and the Gulf states. So our call on the Secretary General today certainly is to increase the pressure, to really push hard on the Chinese and the Russians to change their position, and allow the Arab League to do what it's really doing, what it should be doing.
The issue of armed intervention in Syria, where does Amnesty stand?
Well, right now the immediate issue is that the Syrian government has to stop the bombardment. That is the core issue, and allow humanitarian access. Now, Amnesty is not called for use of force. I mean, that's something which, we don't do, because we are not experts in the issue of using force or not. I think the immediate issue is really about allowing unfettered access to independent human rights monitors. It's to stop the arms flow, because the arms embargo, which we've been calling for a long time, has not happened. Navi Pillay has also called again for a Naomi Pillay, the High Commissioner for Human Rights, has called for Syria to be referred to the International Criminal Court. That needs to happen. There are other sort of issues which are getting less attention. For example, we have a team right now sitting on the borders in Jordan, and there's a massive flow of refugees into Jordan. And many of these people who are coming out into Jordan and Turkey, unfortunately, are being pushed back by some of these governments back into Syria, which creates an additional risk for them. And the asset freeze, you know, there's not been a systematic asset freeze on Bassad and his family. These are the things which we feel can make a difference. Of course, we need a broader political settlement. Amnesty's general view is that increasing the flow of arms into Syria can't really help anybody.
You think Assad should leave? There's word that Tunisia might be offering him asylum.
Yeah, I mean, in most of these places, as you know, even in Egypt and Tunisia, it's not just a question of the dictators leaving, because we have to see an end to dictatorships. So it's not just Assad. It's a system which has to change. It has to be the full observance of international human rights standards. It's not just a matter of one person, because Assad is surrounded by a whole group of people who are violating international human rights law and humanitarian law. So I think Assad is in a sense iconic, but it goes beyond Assad. Hmm.
Iran and Syria, there is a connection between the two. Talk about that connection and what you are seeing in this lead up to these parliamentary elections Friday.
The elections are going to be taking place in early March, and that has really heightened the issue of the domestic human rights violations inside Iran. And our worry is that because of the Arab Spring, and now because of this whole whipping up of anxiety around Iran's nuclear program, what is happening effectively is that the Iranian government is getting away with a massive increase in human rights violations in the last few weeks. And we have a report which we released just a few days ago, which describes this in great detail. So I think the first thing is to bring a focus back onto the Iranian domestic human rights violations. That's absolutely crucial. Very on the ground, what we are seeing, let's not forget that since February 2011, which is when the first initial protests inside Iran started, we have key opposition leaders like Mousavi, Karoubi under arrest, not just them, but their families as well. But in the last few weeks, what we've seen is, you know, a spate of unfair and arbitrary detentions of artists, journalists, students. And the most recent one is a sort of a cyber army that they've created to start tracking internet bloggers. And most recently, we have a situation where Mohammad Ghazali has been one of the bloggers, well-known bloggers, has been arrested for 4.5-year term plus 10 years of what they're calling internal exile. BBC journalists, you I'm sure you're aware, the Persian service, one of them was arrested as well. So a lot of harassment is happening right now. So our call on the Iranian government right now really is to allow for a public debate which needs to happen before the parliamentary elections. And, you know, allow for international human rights obligations, basic freedoms, you know, freedom of association, expression, assembly have to be in place. You may be aware that in 2011, the number of executions which have happened in Iran is 4 times as much as happened the previous year. And many of these are also cases of juvenile executions, all these so-called drug offenses. And, you know, juvenile execution is absolutely prohibited under international human rights law. So I think there's a lot of work to be done in Iran. And our worry on Iran is that, you know, somehow they're not in the focus anymore because, and as you said, it's very linked now to Syria as well. And the paradox, of course, is that the Iranian government was welcoming what was happening in Egypt and Tunisia and Bahrain, but they are not ready to accept their own people expressing their opinions and voice.
And what about Amnesty's position on crackdowns in Saudi Arabia and Bahrain, human rights abuses there, which are traditionally U.S. allies?
No, I mean, those are the elephants in the room. Saudi Arabia and Bahrain, it really exposes sort of double standards. I mean, it's true that the U.S. government has voiced some concern in Bahrain, but we have one of our people right now in visiting Bahrain, and the number of restrictions we have even on our staff entering now is increasing on a daily basis. You know, they want us to take permissions, etc., which is simply not possible for us to do. I mean, As such, amnesty never enters the country unless we get government permission. So, which is why we cannot enter into Syria and Iran. But Bahrain has historically been more open, but you know now they've really tightened on any independent monitoring. So, Saudi Arabia, in my view, is simmering. We don't really hear much about what's happening there, but. And the U.S. government's behavior in relation to Saudi Arabia and Bahrain is not any different from what they've historically done, which is to put their interests ahead of their values.
We only have a few minutes. I want to get to Egypt, but I want to ask you about the arms trade first.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's one of the reasons we are here this week. The arms trade issue is very central to what we're discussing. I mentioned we had ships landing in Tartus, Russian ships landing to support the Syrian dictatorship. And this is symbolic of the deeper problem of unregulated arms flow across the world. Billions of dollars of business interests. The paradox here again is that the Security Council members, the five permanent members plus Germany, account for almost 70-80% of arms trade in the world.
So, U.S. in particular?
The U.S. is a big contributor. So obviously you have a conflict of interest in some ways, literally. But the issue really is that, finally, we are close to having a sort of global arms trade treaty in place. This, unfortunately, is not getting much traction in the U.S. media, etc., because it's tended to become a U.N. internal process. It really needs to become much more
visible.
And
what has been the U.S. position on the arms trade treaty?
So the U.S. position is generally supportive that there needs to be an arms trade treaty. I think, the main issue for us is what we're calling a golden rule, that any arms trade, before it happens, it needs to be tested to see if it's going to lead to human rights violations. Now, in this particular issue, the U.S. has been a bit more cautious, and their argument has been that they have domestic regulation, which is already quite strong. But we don't really understand that argument, because if they do have stronger domestic regulation, then there should be no worries in signing up to a global treaty which is powerful. Because the worry is not just about U.S., but it's about China, Russia, Iran.
Is the U.S. resisting?
I mean, there's always a historical resistance to anything which is international. So there's always these arguments about sovereignty, etc. I'm sure they want to reserve some of their rights around the sort of so-called war on terror. There's all of those things happening. But I think part of the reason is that people have not really focused on this, and that's one of the things we want to speak to Ambassador Rice today as well about.
Finally, you've just returned from Egypt. Talk about the significance of what is happening there now.
Well, changes in Egypt are massive. Just to give you one example, but the fact of the matter is that, as I said, the dictators have gone, but the dictatorships haven't. So just when you enter into the airport, when we are walking in with amnesty materials, we get stopped at the airport and the customs guy at the front end. Historically, when amnesty people enter, you get interrogated for hours, you're made to wait. And the same thing happened to this. The guy said, can you wait? I have to check your materials. And then he called his boss, and his boss came and said, what's wrong with you? This is the new Egypt. You shouldn't be doing this. But it's going to take a long time for that to change. But the big issue right now is the behavior and the practices being followed by the Supreme Council of Armed Forces, the military generals who are running the country right now. One of our big concerns is the use of military trials.
More than 10 seconds.
12,000 people... during Mubarak's period. So they need to rein in security forces, and they need to follow international humanitarian law and human rights law.
Salil Shetty, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Secretary General of Amnesty International. That does it for our broadcast. If you'd like to get a copy, go to our website at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Has a job opening. We're hiring a full-time...
I'd love to work at Democracy Now!, actually. Well, thank you to Democracy Now! For that interview with Salil Shetty, the Secretary General of the... Amnesty International. All right, that does it for our program for March 2nd, 2012. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved with the show, or give us an important news tip, please contact us through our email, news@citr.ca. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to past shows at citr.ca. You can also listen to our past interviews on the News 101 page on mixcloud.com. For more independent news, join us on Monday and Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Chirag Mahajan. Today's show was produced by Morgan Yee.
Woo!
From the entire news team at CITR, thank you for listening. Stay tuned for Stranded at 6 p.m. with Matt right here on CITR 101.9 FM.